Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. With the presidential election just 99 days away, Joe Biden is releasing a number of policy plans, including a $2 trillion climate plan. It's centered around environmental justice and green jobs. Today's guest, reporter Marianne Lavelle, reports that the $2 trillion investment marks a step up from the $1.7 trillion plan Biden unveiled during the Democratic primary battle. He is accelerating his timetable for action, seeking to put the United States on track to achieve net zero emissions 4 years earlier than his original goal of 2050. A number of climate activists say that they clearly made a difference in this plan because it is a drastic improvement. But one of their criticisms is that it doesn't really talk about the future of fossil fuels. Joining us with more is Marianne Lavelle, an award-winning reporter with Inside Climate News, where she covers the environment, science, and law. Hi, Marianne. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, before diving in and talking about Joe Biden's plans, again, because of COVID, so much news is really focused on the outbreak for obvious reasons. But the pandemic has really shifted the focus away from the Trump administration continuing its deregulation mission. Can you just talk about what has really happened over the past couple of months when it comes to environmental issues?
Yes, it's really interesting because very much out of the spotlight, the Trump administration has continued its efforts on environmental deregulation and, in fact, has accelerated them. There have been a series of decisions, particularly on air pollution, that really either roll back the protections or just make decisions that would kind of put in place even beyond the Trump administration a much lower bar on pollution, and that is just continuing really apace. There's at least four or five different regulations in play, and it has been very clear from the timetable they put out, that's the Environmental Protection Agency put out, that they intend to finish this all by the end of President Trump's first term.
And something that just came out last Friday, I'm reading from the Seattle Times, Trump officials concluded that a proposed gold and copper mine in Alaska, which would be the largest in North America, would not pose serious environmental risks. This is a sharp reversal from a finding by the Obama administration that it would permanently harm the region's prized sockeye salmon. So this is also a huge change.
Yes, that is major. That is would be the largest or one of the largest mines of its type in a very environmentally sensitive area. You can count on the legal challenges to that project centering around the inadequacy of that environmental assessment.
Marianne, we've asked you and other guests in the past what it will take or how difficult it will be to reverse these, well, reversals, to reverse the deregulation. And we've got a number of different answers. Given that the election is right around the corner, let's say Biden wins. How difficult will it be to tackle all of these changes?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I'm not surprised that you got all different answers, because I think it is going to depend on the regulation. Some of them are going to be easy to just sweep aside because they were done so late in the process, and they are preliminary. Others will be more difficult to undo. I think an example is the rollback of the Obama Clean Power Plan. Well, they have gone through the whole process of, number one, repealing the old regulation, and number two, putting in place the new regulation. Now, that new regulation is being litigated in the courts right now. We don't know what the result of that litigation will be. If the courts decide, then if the courts decide it's not within the, it was not within the Trump administration's authority, that will make it easy for Joe Biden. But if they do decide that what the Trump administration did was legitimate, then Biden is going to have to take another approach. And I think that if you look at this plan that he put out, this $2 trillion climate plan, he is anticipating the need for Congress to just write totally new law. Remember what Obama did. Obama could not get Congress to agree to anything on climate. And so what Obama did was he used the Clean Air Act, which dates back to 1970, and said, hey, we have authority to regulate pollution under the Clean Air Act. And he pressed as far as he could go on that. And perhaps for Joe Biden, and you can almost see this in his plan, there's a recognition that something more durable is needed. And something that's durable is something, a new law just dedicated to climate goals, and that, you know, executing that law instead of trying to use an old law that is a powerful law. The Clean Air Act is a powerful law, but it gives the opponents a way to challenge it that they would not have if Congress said, we say this is the law and this is the policy of the United States to address climate change. Biden says in the very top of his climate plan that he wants to see Congress pass something with goals to be met by 2025, which would be by the end of his first term in office.
You know, Marianne, we also got different answers whenever we asked our guests, can Biden use his executive power to reverse some of these environmental deregulations? How would you answer that?
I hate to be sit on the fence here, but for some of them he can and some he can't. It's interesting. One of the very consequential things that the Trump administration did was they basically remade all of the science advisory committees to get rid of anyone who, any scientist who ever got EPA grants. And the upshot of that was there are mostly industry scientists on those committees now. There are two federal court rulings that was not permissible, and I think that Joe Biden will be able to remake those committees and have the mix of scientists that the committees used to have, the science advisory boards. And those are important because they kind of they help to shape the environmental policy. And they've definitely been important to the Trump administration. Right. So I think he'll be able to do that. Other things are going to be more difficult. And it also depends on what the court does about some of these decisions that are being, you know, right before the courts right now, the fuel economy standards. We don't know what the courts are going to say about that, but there's some very strong challenges to the legality of what the Trump administration did.
And with the $2 trillion plan, Biden's team said the proposal includes a combination of executive actions and legislation, because if the Republicans maintain control of the Senate, and right now there's a big question over whether that will happen, there's no way that the legislation will pass.
Right. So he's going to have to have, he's going to have to be prepared to go forward just as the Obama administration did, using executive power. What Biden, you can tell from the way he talks about these things, he has this long history in the Senate. He has this a history that Obama didn't have. And he is going to try to come up with a plan that has more consensus, and probably is going to try to win over some of those Republicans who have, you know, voiced concerns about climate, and that includes Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, that sort of thing. So he'll be reaching out to those folks, but I do think he will be going forward with executive authority as well. And by the way, when he walks into office, there'll be this whole slew of executive orders that the Trump administration has put in, and I am sure one of the first things he's going to do is wipe those aside, and that is something he can easily do. There's executive orders meant to accelerate construction of pipelines and oil and gas pipelines, that sort of infrastructure. I have to say the Trump administration has not been entirely successful doing that by executive order, and I think Biden will probably be putting those in the waste can when he first gets into office.
I'm glad you brought this up, Marianne, because you just reminded me. I read an article in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago about Donald Trump consulting with John Yoo, George W. Bush's torture lawyer, on how to skirt laws and rule by decree. This really does send a message that he's planning to do a lot in the next 3 months.
He's done a lot as well. It was pretty surprising that in the middle of this COVID pandemic, that he actually used that as a reason to accelerate pipeline construction, oil and gas pipeline construction. And he signed an executive order on that, kind of pointing to his emergency authority under the law. Now, that emergency authority has never been used for something like building pipelines. He is arguing that we have an economic emergency and that we need to sweep aside these environmental regulations in order to quick get people jobs building the pipeline. It this would be an extraordinary thing for the court to uphold that. I am sure if he tries to go forward, it will face challenges. But it just speaks to how, in many ways, he's taking what really wasn't put in place during the Bush-Cheney era after 9/11, Of course, this is what's happening in Portland, right? The Department of Homeland Security sort of apparatus is being used for President Trump's purposes in his agenda in a way that it wasn't before. Those troops who focused on immigration, terrorism, now focusing on domestic protests. Well, the same thing, you can see that same sort of thing happening in the environmental realm to some extent. When the Trump administration says we want to use the emergency authority that the executive has in order to, give the oil and gas companies a pass on the environmental regulations that they usually have to go through, the hurdles they have to go through before they get one of these pipelines built.
Today we're speaking with Marianne Lavelle, an award-winning reporter with Inside Climate News. And if you have any questions about Joe Biden's $2 trillion climate plan, now would be a good time to call. And in about 10 or 15 minutes, we will talk about the recent rulings ordering major oil and gas pipeline projects to shut down. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So, Marianne, this plan was released as the result of a joint task force put together with Senator Bernie Sanders. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is co-chair of the task force. Varshini Prakash, co-founder of the youth-led Sunrise Movement, was also on this team. And you actually quoted Varshini Prakash in one of your recent pieces. Varshini said that activists can take credit for the moves by Biden to increase the scale and urgency of climate investments. But of course, she said the work is not over. So let's first talk about how this plan would affect disadvantaged communities, because they're the ones that are first affected by the climate crisis. As you report, disadvantaged communities would receive 40% of the clean energy and infrastructure benefits. New monitoring of pollution would be mandated in communities at the fence line of refineries and other facilities that have borne the brunt of the nation's pollution burdens. So tell us more about how this would work.
Right. Right now, everyone knows that these communities have the worst burden of pollution, but the regulations on their air pollution really have allowed the refiners and other facilities themselves to report what their emissions are. It gives them all sorts of breaks for high pollution at times of shutdowns and startups and malfunctions. Well, you add it all up, and these communities can be getting lots of blasts of pollution and really not know when it's happening. For years, these environmental justice communities have been asking for something like real-time monitoring of pollution. And I think it's really interesting that that is part of the Biden climate plan, because, really puts front and center where some of the worst pollution burden from fossil fuels is. And, would use the technology that we have these days to do sort of real-time monitoring and let these communities know what pollutants are being released in their midst. And it also lets all of us know the cost of our continued reliance on fossil fuels.
Adding to that point, the Washington Post is reporting that the Office of Environmental and Climate Justice, which would, it's the first time that this office would ever exist. This would be at the DOJ. The Post reports that this office would prosecute pollution cases and hold corporate executives personally accountable. Can you tell us more about that? Because I thought that was a really interesting line in the Post, but they didn't elaborate.
It's pretty interesting because in the past, the government could begin enforcement action using the usual environmental laws, and they could make a concerted effort to let's focus our efforts on some of these hard hit environmental justice communities. This really creates a separate office in the Justice Department just to look at environmental justice issues. And I think that this is so important in the midst of this public health crisis, the COVID crisis, where you're seeing that minority communities are really the worst hit as far as fatalities. And the other thing that we know is that these communities have some of the highest levels of pollution, and they deal with this, you know, day in and day out. We're just starting to see the first science come out showing that long-term exposure to air pollution seems to increase risk of fatalities from COVID. And so what this Office of Environmental Justice would do is make it kind of part of the law enforcement mission of the federal government to look back at that historic environmental burden that these communities have in a way that they haven't before, really holding executives criminally liable for this kind of pollution and for the decisions that have led to this unfair burden that these communities have faced for so long.
And Marianne, before we let you go, you know, we just did a show about Cancer Alley, and we spoke with activists in Louisiana who are trying to prevent yet another plastics company from Formosa open in their community. I mean, most of the people there know someone, they might have a loved one who has died from cancer. A lot of people in this country still don't have clean water. When you look at Biden's plan, what are your thoughts about the actual tangible changes that will be seen and felt in these communities? How long will this take?
I think that you quoted the Sunrise Movement leader, Barshini Prakash. She talks about how our work isn't over, that we have to keep pushing. And I think that really is true. How quickly Joe Biden will move on, if he's elected, how quickly he will move on these issues really depends on how much pressure he's feeling. Remember, he's going to be coming into office in the midst of the COVID crisis, one of the worst economic crises that the country has ever faced. It really is going to be incumbent on those who care about these issues to make sure that climate change and environmental justice continue to be top priorities, and that addressing them is kind of holistic with the effort to remake the economy. And that's really the way Biden's plan has put it, that we're not going to put off dealing with climate justice to rebuild the economy. We're going to make environmental and climate justice part of rebuilding the economy. So I still think it's going to be very important to keep the pressure on to make that happen, but that is definitely the goal that he has set out.
Well, Marianne, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Marianne Lavelle is an award-winning reporter with Inside Climate News. Coming up after a break, we will continue talking about Joe Biden's $2 trillion climate plan. We should mention that the New York Times said in order to pay for it, Biden is proposing an increase in the corporate income tax rate back to 28% from 21%, asking the wealthiest to pay their fair share. We will also talk about the recent rulings ordering major oil and gas pipeline projects to shut down, including the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll find out how families and educators are preparing for another semester of remote learning. Here in California, 90% of K through 12 schools will operate remotely. We're talking about how what an equitable remote learning environment would actually look like. And then on Wednesday, we will talk about how college students and educators are preparing for remote learning. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's show, we're talking about Joe Biden's $2 trillion climate plan. And then we are going to talk about the recent rulings ordering major oil and gas pipeline projects to shut down. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Now I'd like to welcome Phil McKenna to the show. Phil is an award-winning energy and environment reporter for Inside Climate News. Hi, Phil. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Joy Braun, a frontline community organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. Joy was one of the first campers at Standing Rock's Sacred Stone Camp, and Joy is a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. Hi, Joy. Thank you for joining us.
Hi.
Joy, I just wanted to ask you about Joe Biden's climate plan. It really does center disadvantaged communities that have been hit the hardest. A number of activists with the Sunrise Movement say that it's one of the most intersectional climate plans from any Democratic nominee in history. It also makes references to tribal communities. It calls for expanding broadband access to tribal lands. The main criticism here, though, is that it really doesn't focus on the future of fossil fuels. I just wonder what your thoughts are on the plan.
Well, we really do need to be working on more of a just transition away from fossil fuels. However, the Biden plan still focuses on cap and trade and carbon credits. And this is their back door to allow polluters to keep polluting in black and brown communities and disadvantaged communities. And what that does is it still allows companies to have credits to still, for people to still get cancer, for people to still have their water rights threatened, for tribal communities to still be targeted. So he can say all these wonderful, really cool things, but until we face head on that carbon credits are a false solution, there is nothing that's going to change as far as environmental justice is concerned.
Mm. Phil, have you been following this plan? What are your thoughts on that, based on what you're hearing from activists?
Yeah, I mean, two things that really strike me, the $2 trillion on clean energy development in the next 4 years and a 2035 target for 100% clean energy, both very ambitious plans. I think a lot remains to be seen with the target, if it is reached, how binding it is, but really moving and rapidly moving in polar opposite direction from the current administration.
Joy, what about pipelines? Where does Biden stand on the future of pipelines?
Well, if we're going to face pipelines, we need to face the big elephant in the room, and that's fracking.
Right.
And Biden has said straight out that he's not going to attack fracking. We have to stop fracking. Fracking causes an enormous amount of pollution. It has also caused a huge epidemic in the indigenous community that is missing and murdered indigenous women and persons. So we have to face fracking.
And this is directly related to the man camps. I just was watching a video of a new pipeline in Canada, and it was just incredible to see how fast these these small, it's almost like when you have a separate school and this is where all the workers live, and you know, so many communities have just seen, you know, these man camps come to town, and as a result, you know, there's missing and murdered indigenous women and girls,
and missing and murdered indigenous women and persons. You have an increased amount of drug trafficking, increased amount of violence, increased amount of traffic, just traffic in general. My reservation, the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe Reservation, is going to be surrounded by three man camps regarding the Keystone XL pipeline. And the largest of that is going to be 1,400 men. We're a very small, you know, we have little villages of less than 60 people in the villages. These men, they don't listen to our tribal laws, our resolutions. They have no respect for our checkpoints with regarding COVID. So it's really a very scary situation we're facing right now.
So 1,400 men are going to work on the Keystone XL?
That's just one camp. One camp. The other two are going to be 600 persons. And that's just here in South Dakota. That's not including Montana and Nebraska.
Wow. Can you give us an update on the Keystone XL pipeline, Joy?
Yeah, so right now the national permit number 12 has been suspended just for Keystone XL pipeline, not for other projects. This is with regard to the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act. So the pipeline cannot cross navigable rivers right now. So that would be the Missouri, the Yellowstone, the Cheyenne River, the White River, the Niobrara, and the Platte River. And because of endangered species that are being threatened and water discharge from fracking, that they need to go underneath these particular rivers. However, they are still constructing man camps. They're still constructing pump stations, and they're still constructing pipe yards. So what they're doing is they're doing all this so-called pre-construction. Of course, we believe all pre-construction is construction, but they're continuing with pre-construction work, and these armed security guards and armed officers are still roaming our areas and threatening our people.
So what about the ruling that came down in early July? I'm just reading from the New York Times here. The Supreme Court rejected a request from the Trump administration to allow construction of parts of the Keystone pipeline that had been blocked by a federal judge in Montana, but the court temporarily revived a permit program that would let other oil and gas pipelines cross waterways after only modest scrutiny from regulators.
This is regarding nationwide permit number 12. And these nationwide permits are like these umbrella permits that projects on pipelines, transmission lines, cable lines can apply and just say, oh, we've done the cursory work, so you're going to have this general permit and you can move forward. However, the judge ruled that with regards to Keystone XL pipeline, they couldn't move forward under nationwide permit number 12, but other projects could.
And then what about the Dakota Access Pipeline? Phil, you reported, let's see here. Well, it's been confusing because the federal court delivered a victory for the Sioux Tribe, as you reported, another blow for the Dakota Access Pipeline. Can you just give us an update on that?
Yeah, and sure. First, I should say, within 24 hours, it was quite a day for not only Dakota Access, but Keystone XL, and also the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, where either three rulings or decisions by the pipeline companies all had major setbacks for all of these pipelines. But the ruling that came on July 6th for Dakota Access, yes, it said that during an ongoing environmental review, a much more complete environmental review than has been done to date for the Dakota Access Pipeline, that oil has to stop flowing through that pipeline and has to stop within 1 month, so coming up on August 5th. It's something that Energy Transfer, the owner and operator of the pipeline, is and will challenge in court, but was a huge and likely unprecedented victory for the opponents of the pipeline, in that it shut down an operating oil pipeline, something that I can't think of a court doing before.
Joy, what was your response to this ruling?
Well, it was really good news that we had the ruling. Of course, Energy Transfer Partners immediately appealed and wanted a review of that ruling and asked for injunctive relief. They were granted that up until Thursday of last week, where people could write, or other parties could write amicus briefs. And so we're waiting to hear what the judge will or will not provide any kind of relief for Energy Transfer Partners to keep oil flowing. Of course, we argue that they need to follow what the original judge said and stop the oil flowing in the Dakota Access Pipeline. And whether or not they're saying that it's going to be economically disadvantaged for the state of North Dakota, that really doesn't matter, because under COVID right now, there is hardly any oil flowing right now. And other pipelines have been ordered to stop on the three affiliated tribes. There was another pipeline there that they have to give $1.87 million to three affiliated members, because it was shown that they put a pipeline there illegally. So there's just not oil flowing right now coming out of North Dakota, not in the way that Energy Transfer is trying to say it is.
Joy, Mike Faith of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe said this pipeline should have never been built there. We told them that from the beginning. When it came down, he said, today is a historic day for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. And I just wonder, Joy, given that you were one of the first campers at Standing Rock Sacred Stone Camp, what is it like to just be involved in this fight for so long? I mean, there's legal battles, there's a change in administrations. The movement continues, and you never know what's going to come down from the courts.
Well, you know, I started fighting pipelines with Keystone XL over 10 years ago, and, you know, we thought we had won under Obama, and then I'm back again fighting it again, the zombie pipeline. Hmm. So with Dakota Access, after we were removed and the spirit told us that we needed to continue the fight in the court system, I kind of expected that there would be a lot of back and forth. That's kind of how these fights are. They're long-lasting fights. When you go into them, you go in it to win it, but it's very long-lasting.
Well, if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about oil and gas pipelines, we're talking about the recent rulings. ordering projects to shut down. Joy Braun is a frontline community organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network, one of the first campers at Standing Rock Sacred Stone Camp, and a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. Phil McKenna is an award-winning energy and environment reporter for Inside Climate News. Phil, what insights can you give us just about how these court battles linger on and what's involved, what goes on behind the scenes?
Oh, I think it's really a testament to the opposition, pipeline opponents who are waging these years-long battles. As Joy mentioned, it's happening both physical opposition at the camps, but at the same time, starting at the very beginning in 2016 when the camps were first forming, Standing Rock and other tribes were also filing suit and engaging in these costly years-long battles that ultimately slow down and, in this case, stopped Dakota access. But it was also cited as the reason that the Atlantic Coast Pipeline was canceled, where Dominion Energy and Duke Energy pulled out of a multi-billion-dollar pipeline project. Initially, $5 billion had ballooned to $8 billion as all of these delays from opponents in court slowed down and ultimately led to the cancellation of the project. And I think it really gives pipeline builders pause going forward because they know that they're going to be in for a long, drawn-out battle with the people who do not want to see these pipelines built.
And Joy, a lot of people argue that these legal victories are the result of shoddy permits in many cases and the growth of the environmental movement. Can you just talk about some of the changes that you've seen with the environmental movement since Standing Rock?
Well, a large part of what's gone on here in North Dakota and South Dakota is, and in other places with other extractive industry sites, is looking at the indigenous perspective and looking at treaty rights. Dakota Access Pipeline was crossing 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, which we have never ceded. We've never ceded that land. We were forcibly removed, and we've never ceded that land. And they did not have free, prior, informed consent for that pipeline to go through. And the same thing with Keystone XL Pipeline. No free, prior, informed consent. But as you look across the nation, you see that the environmental movement has finally starting to put the indigenous voice at the forefront. And we have to remember that we were here first. This is our land. It's always going to be our land. And our voices need to be heard and respected.
Right. It's such an important point. And Phil, as a reporter who covers these issues, it's so important to add in context around treaties, like what Joy said. I mean, a lot of people in this country, you know, they're not familiar with treaties. They don't really know the history of treaties. Can you talk about just the importance of adding that context and centering indigenous voices in these stories?
I think we're seeing a really strong growth in tribal sovereignty being exercised effectively in these pipeline battles. We're seeing it not only in Dakota Access, but across the country. Minnesota, Wisconsin in particular, with additional pipelines, Line 3 and Line 5, that would either be looking to be expanded or continued. One tribe in northern Wisconsin, the Bad River Band, was able to get a pipeline that had been in the ground for, I believe, 60 years when the lease for it was up. They decided they no longer wanted it and successfully fought to have the pipeline removed, and now looks like it will have to be rerouted around the reservation. So I really think we're in a period where tribal rights, tribal sovereignty is increasingly being exercised and is becoming an effective way for pipeline opponents, for tribal members who don't want these pipelines routed through their reservations to push back.
And Joy, at a time when so much of the media coverage right now is on COVID, and then, of course, with the election just 99 days away, that's going to be a major focus. What are some of the issues around pipelines that maybe are not getting as much attention as they should? What do people need to know about?
Well, I think people need to realize that if we look here in South Dakota, for example, Governor Kristi Noem has really been attacking the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe and our tribal health checkpoint. But that's a cover because she doesn't want us to exercise our sovereign right to stop Keystone XL traffic. So we need to really look at what tribal issues are facing as far as sovereignty issues are concerned. We just have the McGirt case in Oklahoma. We have yet to see how that is going to shake out in Indian country. When Trump went up to the Black Hills, there was protests up there. I was not up there because I was following tribal law and staying home because of COVID. But we need to look at what other things we are going to be facing from state governments and from the U.S. government, and how these new cases are going to be affecting us, especially things like McGirt.
Right. And McGirt, if people aren't familiar with that, we'll put a link up. The McGirt case is a historic win for tribes. Julian Brave Noise Cat wrote a piece for The Atlantic. Joy, can you talk about the role that Indigenous people are going to be playing in this election? When we're talking about Joe Biden's plan, you know, obviously a number of activists say that, you know, they're going to be pushing him really hard to center frontline communities in his plan. So what role will Indigenous people play in the coming months?
Well, we sincerely hope that Biden reaches out to Indigenous communities and to tribal nations. Tribal nations historically vote Democrat. Not all of them, but historically vote Democrat. And it would be to his best interest for his campaign to reach out to our communities, to really see what we are facing and how we can develop renewable energies and jobs for our tribal nations. My reservation is ready to put out a wind farm, for example, something we fought very hard for under the Obama administration, but have yet to have it built because of the Trump administration. So it would be best for him to reach out. One of the things that we're facing in Indian country is people don't like to vote in national elections because we don't historically feel that they are representative of us as people. And like here in South Dakota, we could not vote until 1957. So we don't even feel like for the most part that we can go vote. And when you do go vote, oftentimes you don't know where you're voting. Election sites have been cut in a lot of states, and you have to drive places, and people don't have a lot of money to do that. So how can those things be solved internally, like by the states and by the tribes? And what is Biden's plan for helping with that?
What would you add, Phil?
I would say we're really at a turning point looking at the build-out of pipelines. Not only are we seeing increasing opposition from opponents, but market forces are becoming increasingly at play in determinations of whether to continue building out or not. This spring, with the COVID shutdown, we saw briefly negative prices for the price of crude oil. There's also the growing strength of the divestment movement that started on U.S. campuses, college campuses, and is now expanding and really gaining strength and causing pause in finance circles on whether to finance additional pipelines. And at the same time, you're seeing lawsuits, multiple cities and states that are seeking to hold fossil fuel companies financially liable for knowingly spreading disinformation about climate change and profiting off of its impacts. So I think this is a really interesting time. This is all coming too during the administration, the Trump administration, that made one of its main points to expedite the growth of the fossil fuel industry. So we may see oil and gas following the same trajectory as coal over the last couple of decades. We're just growing market forces, lower costs, renewables, may be signaling kind of peak gas, peak coal, peak oil, and fewer pipelines like this. But it is going to take a concerted effort by Joy. Like Joy is saying, if opponents are going to continue to have these victories.
Phil McKenna is an award-winning environment reporter for Inside Climate News. Phil, thanks for your work. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Joy Braun is a frontline community organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network, one of the first campers at Standing Rock Sacred Stone Camp, and a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. Joy, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio going. You can find out more about the issues that we discussed today, including Joe Biden's $2 trillion climate plan and the recent rulings ordering major oil and gas pipeline projects to shut down, at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we will find out how families and educators are preparing for another semester of remote learning. Here in California, 90% of K through 12 schools will be learning online. Parents across the country are creating education pods for their kids. Some public education advocates warn that will widen disparities among low-income students. So what would an equitable remote learning environment look like? I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. You can listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast. Go to kalw.org. And if you're listening on iTunes, be sure to leave us a review. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.